Welcome to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice on WSCA LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio, your local connection to the world. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, May 28, 2005. Here's what's coming up. Our first hour will feature Down to Earth, Environmental Matters and Appreciation with Jeff White. Jeff talks with Doug Bogan from Clean Water Action in Portsmouth about their campaign against mercury poisoning. We'll also have music and announcements in our first hour for you. In our second hour, we'll play Amy Goodman's speech that she delivered in Portsmouth early this month. First, we go to Jeff White with some news.
Greetings, this is Jeff with some news for Making Waves. This story is from the Associated Press. Laura Bush waded into Middle East tensions on Sunday during chaotic visits to sacred religious sites, where crowds and hecklers grew so rowdy that armed guards had to restrain them. America's First Lady said that what she witnessed showed that passions are running high amongst Palestinians and Israelis. At the Western Wall, Judaism's holiest shrine, protesters demanded that the U.S. release an American Jew imprisoned for spying for Israel. At her stop nearby at the Dome of the Rock, she faced heckling from angry Palestinians. One man yelled, "How dare you come in here? Why your husband kill Muslims?" Mrs. Bush's five-day visit to the Middle East was intended partly to help diffuse anti-American sentiment in the region. Kind of ironic. Strains have arisen because of the U.S.-led war in Iraq and allegations that American interrogators have mistreated Muslim prisoners. Some visitors that Mrs. Bush encountered near the Dome of the Rock shouted at her in Arabic, "None of you belong in here," one man yelled as Mrs. Bush and her entourage arrived. As she left the area, visitors and media grew so aggressive that Israeli police locked arms and encircled her in a wide human chain. U.S. Secret Service agents packed tightly around her. Behind the recent rise in anti-American sentiment is a now-retracted report in Newsweek that Pentagon investigators had found evidence that interrogators at the U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, placed copies of the Quran, the Muslims' holy book, in washrooms to unsettle suspects and flushed a Quran down a toilet. "We in principle don't reject anyone's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but we see in the visit of Mrs. Bush an attempt to whitewash the face of the United States after the crimes that the American interrogators had committed when they desecrated the Quran," the militant Islamic Hamas group said. Adnan Husseini, director of the Islamic Trust that administers the mosque compound, said Mrs. Bush tried to play down the heckling, say it could have happened anywhere. This story also from the Associated Press. One of the military's new wartime challenges is dealing with a global media that allows information that may be false, or I guess it could be true as well, or damaging to U.S. interests to spread instantly around the world. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld reported on Wednesday, "This is really the first war in history that is being conducted in an era of multiple global satellite television networks, 24-hour news outlets with live coverage of terrorist attacks, disasters, and combat operations," Rumsfeld said in a speech to members of the World Affairs Council. U.S. officials, he said, must also deal with, quote, "a global internet with universal access and no inhibitions, email, cell phones, digital cameras wielded by anyone and everyone, and a seemingly casual disregard for the protection of classified information, resulting in a near-continuous hemorrhage of classified documents, detriment of the country." Rumsfeld didn't delve deeply into specifics in his brief talk with members of the civic group, but his comments seemed aimed in part at news outlets that had broadcast messages from terrorist groups or reported stories that had fueled rage against Americans in the Muslim world. The defense secretary was among those who had complained after more than a dozen people died and scores were injured in rioting in Afghanistan earlier this month after Newsweek published a story that U.S. interrogators desecrated a copy of the Quran at Guantanamo Bay. "The United States needs to respond to anti-American messages with greater agility and speed if it is to win the ideological struggle with Islamic extremists," Rumsfeld said. "We'll need to develop considerably more sophisticated ways of using these new means of communication, i.e., embedded reporters, that are now available to reach the many and diverse audiences." Rumsfeld was initially scheduled to speak before the World Affairs Council last May, but canceled his appearance when he was called before Congress to testify about photographs broadcast around the world that showed U.S. soldiers abusing prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. I guess those are some of the things that they don't want you to see in the media. This story is from Reuters. The House of Representatives voted down a measure by 128-300 vote that called on President Bush to devise a plan for withdrawal from Iraq. It came in the form of an amendment to a $491 billion budget for the Pentagon that was passed on Wednesday night. But the withdrawal amendment marks the first time that Congress has officially voted and debated legislation that deals with a withdrawal. No, it won't pass today, but it will give us a chance to talk about it, said Representative Lynn Woolsey, Democrat of California, the sponsor of the amendment. It's an opportunity for the members of Congress who are frustrated that our troops are being killed for a war that wasn't necessary in the first place and that there is no plan in sight to bring them home. Despite the overwhelming defeat, about two-thirds of Democrats voted for it, and so did five Republicans, a dramatic shift from just a few months ago when talk of a potential withdrawal was taboo for even the most progressive lawmakers. Of the five Republicans to vote for Woolsey's amendment, only one, Representative Walter Jones of North Carolina, spoke in favor of it on the House floor. Jones, one of the most conservative members in Congress, led the campaign in 2003 to change French fries to Freedom Fries. Interesting. "We've never voted one time together in my 11 years here," said Jones, referring to Representative Woolsey. "When I voted 2 years ago to submit the troops, I was making my decisions on facts. Since that time, I've been very disappointed on what I've learned about the justification of going into Iraq." This is the guy who wanted to change the name to Freedom Fries. "There are no practical signs the U.S. is getting close to a withdrawal. The defense appropriation bill that the House just passed added an additional $45 billion to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which would bring the total cost of the war to over $300 billion. The House Republican leadership allowed just 30 minutes for debate on the amendment. How generous. Still, it was lively and at times emotional. And this story is from the Interpress Service. The United States has accelerated arms sales to some of the world's most repressive and undemocratic regimes since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, according to a new report from leading arms trade researchers. The report from the Arms Trade Resource Center at New York-based New School University's World Policy Institute says the increase in sales in military grants is a payoff to countries that have either joined what the White House calls its war on terror or have backed the United States in its military exploits in Iraq and Afghanistan. A majority of U.S. arms sales to the developing world also go to regimes, quote, defined as undemocratic by our own State Department or foreign ministry, says the study. According to the report, U.S. supplied arms are involved in a majority of the world's active conflicts, including Angola, Chad, Ethiopia, Colombia, Pakistan, Israel, and the Philippines. The study cites the recent decision by the administration of President Bush to provide new F-16 fighter planes to Pakistan while pledging comparable high-tech military hardware to India, thereby providing U.S. arms to both sides in a long-brewing conflict among two nuclear-armed rivals. Brilliant. And the tens of millions of dollars in U.S. arms transfers to Uzbekistan, where hundreds of anti-government demonstrators were killed last week. This exemplifies the negative consequences of arming repressive regimes, the report says. According to the study, countries defined as undemocratic in the State Department's annual human rights report also are major recipients of U.S. military aid or U.S. weapon systems. These include Saudi Arabia, which received $1.1 billion, Egypt, that was in 1 year alone, by the way, Egypt, $1 billion, Kuwait, $153 million, United Arab Emirates, $110 million, and Uzbekistan, $33 million. Arming repressive regimes while simultaneously proclaiming a campaign against tyranny undermines the credibility of the United States and makes it harder to hold other nations to higher standards of conduct on human rights and other key issues, said Frieda Berrigan, co-author of the study. Natalie Goldring, executive director of the Security Studies Program at the School of Foreign Service at Washington-based Georgetown University, said the Bush administration has failed to demonstrate any link between open-ended weapons transfers and success in fighting terrorists. This report indicates the opposite may well be the case. By lifting controls over weapons transfers, we are more likely to increase the risk of these weapons falling into our adversaries' hands. Enforcing these laws would produce dramatic improvements in U.S. arms transfer policy. But the Bush administration has failed to do so, she added. Berrigan of the World Policy Institute said that no single policy is more at odds with Bush's pledge to end tyranny in our world than the U.S. role as the world's leading arms exporting nation. While the United States doles out billions of dollars in foreign aid every year, Washington tends to favor military aid and weapon sales over other forms of aid, deprioritizing humanitarian, health, and development aid, even though these types of foreign aid have long-term constructive impact, the study adds. The Bush administration's arms trade policies mirror the approach of 30 years ago when then-Secretary of State Henry Kissinger traveled the world treating arms transfers as if they were party favors, Goldring said. These policies are short-sighted and may well create the very threats they are intended to combat, she added. Weapons manufacturers are profiting from an upsurge in contracts to produce U.S.-supplied weapons, Goldring said, but these transfers place current and future U.S. military personnel at risk of attacks from American weapons that have fallen into the wrong hands. Once transferred, we have little control over these weapons. And this story is from the Independent News and Media in the United Kingdom. The United States is condoning torture and abuse in the name of the war on terror, setting up a latter-day gulag and creating a new generation of the disappeared, according to an Amnesty International report. The report from the human rights group accuses governments from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe of systemic and often brutal erosion of civil rights, but its most scathing criticism is directed at the U.S. for using the September 11th attacks as an excuse to ignore international law, and for creating a network of supplicant nations to subcontract illegal detention and mistreatment. Britain is also criticized for attempting to put its soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan beyond the reach of human rights laws, and on occasion, blindly following the United States down the path of abuse. Amnesty criticizes British ministers who have tried to justify the use of evidence in courts obtained through the mistreatment. The organization's Secretary General, Irene Khan, said, "To argue that torture is warranted is to push us back to the Middle Ages. The international community failed to answer calls for help when mass abuse was taking place," Amnesty says. In the Sudanese region of Darfur, the United Nations stopped short of describing the violence against civilians as genocide. Amnesty says the UN was held hostage to Russian arms trade interests and Chinese oil interests when it debated Sudan. There have been a similar lack of action in other parts of Africa, including Zimbabwe and the Democratic Republic of Congo, with the international community seemingly impotent to act against human rights abuses. Mrs. Khan said, "The rest of the world took its lead from the U.S. Guantanamo has become the gulag of our time, entrenching the practice of arbitrary and indefinite detention in violation of international law." The U.S. Defense Department responded to reports saying that detention of the enemy combatants is not criminal in nature, but to prevent them from continuing to fight against the United States. It said review tribunals provide an appropriate venue for detainees to meaningfully challenge their enemy combatant designation, and added that abuse allegations were investigated. And this is my pick of the week. This is from the Canadian Press. ABC's Nightline, which ignited a brief political battle last year with its decision to read the names of Americans killed in Iraq, will do so again this year. Ted Koppel's news program will pay tribute to the more than 900 U.S. troops who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past year in a special Memorial Day broadcast Monday at 11:35 p.m. ABC said Tuesday, Nightline will show photographs of each of the war dead as their names are read. When Nightline devoted a 40-minute edition to reading the names of 721 Iraq war dead during an election year last year, the Maryland-based Sinclair Broadcast Group decided not to air it on its seven ABC stations. Sinclair said the show appeared to be an anti-war message, an assertion ABC denied. "Too often we simply report casualties in terms of numbers," said Tom Betag, Nightline executive producer. "The fallen is our way of reminding viewers, regardless of their feelings about the war, that men and women who have given their lives on our behalf are individuals with names and faces." Support the troops. And have a great week, and do an anti-rain dance. Thank you.
There were birds falling from the sky, fishes drowning in the mud, people between appointments filling their tanks with blood. Farmers had salt and dirt, people worshipped God while wearing a sweatshop shirt. I hear my diplomat voice debating an old school friend who came to the reunion in a truck that seats 8 to 10. He asked me if I voted, then he asked which way. I said I voted. There were storms tearing through the southern seas, children drowning in the road, people with air conditioning said what warming of the globe. There were lawyers laying out the terms of love, homophobes who craned their necks, people resisting war by having kinky sex. Diplomat voice calling up the AM show with a belligerent host who claims to be a normal Joe. He asked if I was married, he asked if I was gay. I said I'm gay every day. A bang followed by a burning smell, the dollar landed with a thud. People we knew the next one was fire instead of flood. There was a circular rally with no PA. When it was my turn I said, people, it's not about uniting. Diplomat voice debating a Republican in the seat next to me on the protest bus to Washington. I asked if he felt guilty, he said he felt betrayed. He asked if I felt innocent, I said guilty.
That was Pierce Woodward with Diplomat Voice. That song will be on his upcoming new release, and we urge you to look for it. Next, we go to Jeff White with Down to Earth, Environmental Matters and Appreciation. Yesterday, May 27th, was the birthday of Rachel Carson. She was born in 1907. Her publication, Silent Spring, helped to call attention to use of pesticides and their adverse effects on human and animal life. On this day, Jeff went and spoke with Doug Bogan of Clean Water Action in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, about their anti-mercury campaign. Let's hear what they had to talk about.
Good afternoon. This is Jeff with Making Waves, and we are now entering the Down to Earth segment of our show. And I'm here in the Clean Water Action office in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, speaking with Doug Bogan on various water issues. If you could tell us, Doug, a little bit about what's going on, what the latest is with the mercury issue in New Hampshire and locally, and maybe whatever you think is relevant on a more national scale. Maybe we could start there.
As listeners have probably heard, I mean, mercury has come under increased scrutiny in the last few years, really over the last decade. because it is becoming very well known that it is a potent neurotoxin, particularly threatens the next generation. Children are affected as they develop in the womb, and young children, and so women of childbearing age, in particular pregnant women, et cetera, need to be most concerned about their exposure to mercury. And this mainly comes through the consumption of fish, both freshwater fish and seafood. And both the state and the federal government have been grappling in recent years with how to reduce mercury, both exposure and the sources of mercury. At this point, the major source of mercury in our environment from human sources is from the burning of coal power plants, such as one that we have right here in Portsmouth, the Schiller Station, just off Gosling Road. These power plants are responsible for upwards of 40 or more percent of the mercury being emitted into our environment, and they've been implicated in local hotspots for mercury, including this whole region of southeast New Hampshire. There are a number of hotspots that have been identified throughout the Northeast, but the one here in New Hampshire appears to be most associated with specific sources, for example, the power plants, and particularly the Bow Merrimack Station in Bow. That's the largest source of mercury in the state. So the state has been dealing with that, and of course the federal government has, really the EPA has advocated their responsibility to address this problem. They're actually trying to redefine mercury as not being toxic, which is just amazing little sleight of hand. We expect it'll be found to be illegal. There are numerous environmental organizations, as well as a number of states, including, I'm happy to add, New Hampshire, that have sued the EPA over this. Some of those suits have just gone in the last week or two. So we're focusing on the state level, working to get the state legislature to address this problem. And there's a bill in the legislature, SB 128, that did pass with flying colors, actually, through the state Senate. 22 out of the 24 state senators voted for one version or another of this bill. And that's quite remarkable when you consider that the makeup of the state Senate. But they recognized that they had to do something about it. The problem, of course, is when it went over to the House, more issues were raised about what's it going to cost and is this feasible and so forth. And, of course, the utility in question that owns these plants, PSNH, has been working very hard to convince people that it just can't be done and it's going to cost too much and we're all going to be freezing in the dark if we push this too hard. We know that that's not true. We know that this is not going to cost very much, most likely less than a dollar per month per ratepayer. You won't even notice it on your electric bills. And, we will be able to substantially clean up the last major unregulated source of mercury in the state. So that's all very important. Unfortunately, that bill has been, as I say, retained in the committee, which means it won't be voted on, it won't go to the full House until next January. They'll be working and will be working over the next few months to come up with a good approach in this legislature in the House to make sure that bill does come out and get passed and really address the problem. So that's what's happening in terms of power plant mercury. The other significant sources of mercury are mercury products, things that contain mercury as part of their operation, particularly things like thermostats that contain 2 to 5 grams of mercury each. Each time somebody throws a thermostat into the trash, it can end up in our incinerators or our landfills, and that's another significant source. And there are many other products as well, mercury switches, thermometers, various medical equipment, as well as fluorescent lamps and small button cell batteries that do contain mercury. That all adds up to many, many pounds of mercury going into the waste stream here in New Hampshire, and we need to be addressing that as well. So there are two bills in the state legislature, one to phase out mercury products and another to ban the disposal of these products in the waste stream. And those have both passed the House, but they're coming up for votes in the state Senate. Unfortunately, the mercury products bill was voted down in the Environment Committee in the Senate. It's not clear whether that will survive on the floor, but the mercury disposal ban, really our last chance on this approach to getting mercury out of the waste stream, is coming up for a vote in the Energy Committee this coming Tuesday, and expected to go to the floor of the Senate the following Thursday. So we do want to get messages in to our senators in support of that legislation. That's HB 371, the mercury products disposal ban. So that's a quick overview of what's going on at the state level and what we're working on to reduce mercury as far as legislative approaches.
Can you tell us why the mercury products bill was not passed?
Well, a lot of it comes down to if it's going to affect business. You know, some senators are just kind of knee-jerk against it. I mean, when you get down to it. And interestingly enough, the story we heard was that BAE Systems, that I'm sure many listeners know is the major arms manufacturer in the state, it appears that they have some components of their equipment that contain mercury, and they argued to a number of state senators that this will hurt their business and could be a national security risk. You know, ignoring completely the fact that the bill has a very generous waiver provision that would allow any company that has a good reason, like national security, to be exempted from that that ban. You know, and certainly there are cases like that where, you know, this effort isn't going to stand in the way of national security. But unfortunately, that kind of argument managed to convince a number of senators on that committee that, you know, this was perhaps not the best thing to do right now. Despite the fact that every other New England state pretty much has passed similar bans, which means that New Hampshire could end up being the dumping ground for these products as well as the waste that results. And we find that a very serious concern because so much of our waste as it is being imported from neighboring states.
Can you talk a little bit about the impacts on, you mentioned the impacts on children and pregnant women? My wife's actually 6 months pregnant, and I don't let her eat fish anymore, period. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering the effects of wildlife. I know there's been a lot of studies on loons and particularly critters and wildlife that hang out in our lakes.
Yeah, there's a new report out. It's really a compendium of almost two dozen studies done on various wildlife. It's quite impressive how much has been pulled together. And for over a decade now, researchers have been sampling loons. They actually are able to capture them live. You know, they don't injure them, but they take a blood test, take a sample of one of their feathers, and they collect whatever eggs that don't hatch, and they can sample them for mercury. And that's been one of the best ways that we've been able to determine the levels of mercury out in the environment, because they're really a indicator species. They're at the top of the food chain. They stay on the same lake year after year. They mate for life, so you can actually track the same bird year after year, and they've been doing this all this time, and they've been able to track trends in mercury and the levels in different lakes around the state. So that has given us a good indication, and you know, that's really the best way to know what's in the environment. There are other species they've been testing as well, other species that eat fish like otter and mink, other birds like eagles and kingfishers. And the most interesting thing came out of the recent research is that even terrestrial birds, songbirds like Bicknell's thrush that lives up in the White Mountains, they found they have elevated levels of mercury, and they previously didn't think that birds at that level could accumulate mercury, because it wasn't thought that they aren't eating fish, of course, they're eating insects, and it wasn't known that the mercury is getting that much into the food chain, into the overall environment, into the terrestrial environment. So, you know, it's certainly a growing concern out there. But what it all means for us is that we do, of course, have to continue to follow the guidelines from the state. There is a statewide fishing advisory. They're not saying no fish, but they're saying for women of childbearing age, pregnant women, and young children, that they should eat no more than one meal per month from the lakes, from any of the water bodies in the state, lakes, rivers, ponds. And that also applies to seafood, although for certain species of seafood, swordfish and shark that are available in this region as well, we feel, this isn't the government's position, but large tuna steaks, really should be avoided altogether for women of childbearing age, and the rest of us need to be careful. Moderation is really the key. We don't advocate, or, you know, they aren't saying that you should avoid fish altogether. There are other species like haddock and pollock and flounder and other, you know, whitefish that are safer, much safer to eat. So people shouldn't be scared out of eating fish altogether if they do consume fish, but we need to be more vigilant. And I'd say particularly with tuna fish, the most common type of fish that people eat, it turns out that white tuna, the albacore tuna, is much higher in mercury than light tuna. So if you're going to eat tuna fish, you should stick to the light tuna, the yellowfin or skipjack tuna, the cheaper stuff, basically. It's much lower in mercury, and you can safely consume more of that, couple cans a week. And again, we really think that, you know, women, pregnant women in particular, should avoid the white tuna, albacore tuna altogether, and not feed it to young children.
So the tuna that we get generally, that most people get in stores around here, would not originate, I'm guessing it wouldn't originate from our coastline, it would originate from South America or Central America?
Yeah, so the Pacific generally is where most of the tuna is caught. At least as far as those species, there is bluefin tuna that is caught off the East Coast, and that generally gets packed in ice and shipped off to Japan, and it's a favorite, I guess, for sushi, very valuable. Unfortunately, it also means it's very high in mercury, so that's another concern. Certainly, if you're a big fan of sushi, might want to avoid the tuna that's in it, or at least not eat very much of it. So, yeah, you're right. It is a global problem, and, you know, you don't often know, although they are starting to label much of the seafood in stores now by law, it's worth keeping in mind that it's a problem all over. And, in fact, China is becoming a big concern because they are growing in their use of coal, meaning much more mercury is, of course, blowing into the Pacific Ocean. But, you know, all countries, and certainly the United States, needs to lead the way in cleaning up mercury, not blame other countries just because, you know, they happen to be upwind. I mean, that seems to be the case. New Hampshire's certainly gone a long way toward, you know, just blaming the neighbors, pointing the finger upwind. We really need to take responsibility and clean up our own sources. And certainly whatever we emit here goes into the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, eventually all the water bodies do drain into the Atlantic, and we have to be concerned about coastal fisheries as well.
So there's no end to the effects of this are enormous, global, that can go from through different animals and people, as far as the food chain, it affects pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little more specifically about the science of it, as far as why is it that the big predator species or species that are on the top of the food chain, such as shark and swordfish and tuna, which tend to be the fish in the ocean that would eat the smaller fish, so to speak, why are they more affected by that? And maybe you could just talk a little about bioaccumulation.
Right. Yeah, that's really the catchword, or biomagnification. What happens is that the mercury gets concentrated as it goes up the food chain. You know, it starts off in the water, gets, absorbed by algae, and then other critters eat the algae, and then fish come along and eat those critters, and other fish eat the smaller fish, et cetera. And each time, it gets magnified maybe tenfold. And so a large fish, you know, in a freshwater system, a bass, largemouth bass, or in the ocean, maybe a swordfish, they can contain up to a million times as much mercury than what's in the surrounding water. So that's an important point, that mercury is not a threat in the water itself. It's not a problem. You go swimming in the lakes, or you drink water out of a lake or a river. There may be other things in it that you got to be concerned about, but mercury isn't one of them as far as direct health exposure. It's really as it goes up the food chain. And the sad thing is that these species at the top, the ones we tend to recognize like loons, are the most impacted. And it is considered the greatest threat to the future health of loons in this region, more so than ingesting lead, which is also a neurotoxin, similar kind of impact. But because mercury is so ubiquitous, it's found in every lake in the state, You know, and of course, loons don't have a choice. They can't stop eating fish. That's what they do. And so, you know, they don't know any better. And the sad thing is that it doesn't kill them outright. It doesn't poison them, such as consumption of lead shot or lead sinkers would. With mercury, it's a subtle impact where it affects their, you know, ability to function so that they can't feed their young, they can't hunt for fish. Obviously the young don't develop properly, and so it has impacts down the generations. So we expect, and they have seen that it has impacted the ability to reproduce out in the environment. And certainly that's true of people as well. I mean, we have to think of it in terms of basically dumbing down our society, that the more continued exposure to mercury means that children won't develop well, there'll be more learning disabilities, more difficulty grasping important things. I mean, we need all the brain power we can get in our society these days with all the problems we have, and it's just really, really sad that so many children are being affected. The EPA and the Centers for Disease Control have estimated that 1 out of 6 women of childbearing age has enough mercury in their bodies right now to constitute a risk to a child if they were to have a child. And that translates to over 500,000 babies born every year at risk. They won't necessarily be brain damaged, but they have the potential of being brain damaged just from mercury alone, let alone all the other toxins that are out there. So that's a pretty serious problem. I mean, when you think about, you know, how many children that affects, it works out to 2,400 babies born in New Hampshire alone at risk from mercury. So it is a significant impact, and a lot of it we just don't know until, you know, years, decades down the line, where people aren't able to function as well as they might have otherwise.
And so it's the connections are pretty direct with mercury, unlike some other things. I mean, as you said earlier, they've been studying this for years, and there's not a whole lot of question here as far as what's causing the effects of mercury poisoning.
Yeah, it's been very well researched. The National Academy of Sciences put out a report back in 2000. I mean, all this is what led to the EPA, at least originally, back in the previous administration, issuing what they called determination to address mercury from power plants. And so, you know, we feel that there's really no reason other than obviously politics for not moving ahead as soon as possible to reduce this.
What about with PSNH? They provide power to my house, and is there any point in putting some pressure on them as far as them being one of the greatest contributors or creators of this problem?
Yeah, well, what we've seen in the process of the, you know, trying to get legislation through is that they are clearly the the bad actor, the folks that are standing in the way, and, you know, only PSNH. And it almost appears irrational, some of their arguments. You know, it just can't be done. I mean, they've had, you know, op-ed pieces in the papers and you know, meetings with the editorial boards and so forth, and they just don't seem to be facing the facts, either the fact that it needs to be addressed and also the facts of what can be done to clean it up. The fact is we have the technology. It's been pretty well demonstrated. You know, give them a few years to figure out, get the engineering worked out, but, you know, it should be able to be done. In fact, they're doing tests next month at the Bow plant to look at how this equipment will reduce mercury. What they do is they inject carbon into the flue gas, and that absorbs the mercury just like a carbon filter on your water faucet would. And that appears to do a pretty good job of reducing the mercury, upwards of 90%. And at a reasonable cost, like I said, I mean, really, you know, pocket change to the average ratepayer. So there's really no reason why they should be so intransigent over this issue. And, yeah, we'd encourage people to, you know, send an email, contact. You can go to, you know, psnh.com, and they probably have a comment line. Let them know that you're not happy with their attitude about this.
As you said, it's very feasible, and it could be very affordable to do this as opposed to some other environmental issues, which really, I'm not sure if we have the solution yet, and I think they wait till there's overwhelming evidence, and it seems like the sky is falling. It's funny because when I think of a company or a government responding to an environmental problem, it's always, if we do this, then the sky is going to fall. And ironically, that's what those same people often say to environmentalists, oh, you're just saying the sky is going to fall, but yet they do that by trying to get out of dealing with the issue. Mm-hmm. And if we do this, then, oh my God, it's going to cost, you know, we won't be able to stay in business. And it seems to me this happens on every single thing. I'm sure with leaded gas, when they tried to get rid of leaded gas, same issue, everything. There's always this rejection of change, and ultimately that denial becomes reality, and they realize they have to change something in order to stay in business.
Yeah, I mean, the good news on this is that, you know, other utilities, other states have been moving forward, and particularly in the Northeast, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New England, and New Jersey have all enacted legislation to require reductions in mercury from their power plants. Other than New York, those are the only states in the Northeast that have coal power plants. So, you know, our neighbors are doing it, and that's a lot of what we've tried to do is just say, look, you know, this is not, you know, you're not, you know, creating the wheel here. This is something that's being done elsewhere. Other companies are figuring out how to respond to it, and PSNH can do it too, you know. And you know, the other perspective on all this is that by not requiring PSNH to clean up, that gives them an unfair advantage if there's ever competition. Right now, we still don't. They're still a regulated monopoly, but if someday the state decides to really do competition in electric utilities, PSNH would have a leg up on all their competitors because they don't have to clean up their plants. They can run their coal plants much more cheaply, and it's just not fair. And that may be better in the short run for New Hampshire ratepayers, but in the long run, obviously, it's not a reasonable system. And, you know, that's what we've argued for a long time, is we need to level the playing field, make them play by the same rules, and just get on with it. So, you know, we feel that can be done. It's really a matter of convincing them that there's no other choice.
What other organizations are working with Clean Water Action on this issue? I noticed on your website there are a bunch of other organizations that were sponsors of the Zero Mercury campaign, basically, that was started in 2000.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a regional campaign throughout all the New England states. Here in New Hampshire, we have the New Hampshire Clean Power Coalition, which includes most of the environmental organizations in the state, as well as public health and other interest groups, groups like Conservation Law Foundation, New Hampshire Sierra Club, and forget a few of them, but quite a long list of groups that are involved in that effort, because you know, we all recognize that these are serious issues. Most everybody has had something to say about it.
Okay, well, I want to thank you, Doug, for talking to Making Waves and Down to Earth today, and we'll be talking to you soon about other issues, so keep us posted on developments. Thank you.
Sure, glad to be here, and I hope to talk with you more in the future.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, the wildness in my soul. And for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood, our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, the tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth. And when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Drops about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free.
That was Dana Lyons with Drop of Water. To hear previous shows of NH Making Waves, please visit our archive online at freewebs.com/SPRAV/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show. And for more information or to hear our website again, please feel free to call the station in the next hour at 430-9722 for that information again. In anticipation of hearing from Amy Goodman on the media, we now bring you a short clip from Howard Zinn, also in relation to the media in the United States at this time.
Professor Zinn, as you know, after the invasion of Iraq, polls showed that up to 60% of the American people fully believed that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 and believed that he was closely associated with Al-Qaeda. Even after President Bush, when he was finally put in a corner, admitted there was no connection, polls showed that still 30% of American people believe that. Now, American people aren't stupid. My opinion, but this is a question to you, is the American corporate media at fault here?
Well, there's no question that you're right. No, I agree with you. The American people are not stupid, but they can be misinformed. And they have been misinformed consistently by the corporate media. Fox Television, CNN, the major newspapers, the major television stations, and the Washington Post, which is a major newspaper, which is supposed to be liberal, admitted some time ago that it had given the American people false information about weapons of mass destruction, that it had gone along and simply conveyed the administration's misinformation about that to the American public. So, no, I agree with you very much that the reason so much of the American public still believes facts which have turned out to be false is because they have had a very bad education by the media. They certainly have had a very bad education in the history of this country, and certainly a bad education about what is going on in the world. We need to look for alternative media. I applaud programs like this, which give us viewpoints that you will not get on NBC or CBS. I applaud Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! and David Bastamian's Alternative Radio and Pacifica, and all those attempts to bring information to the public which it does not get from the corporate media.
We have one last call. Camdenton, Missouri, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. So according to you, in the last 60 years or so, there's a vast conspiracy among all of our legislature, our government, that we're going to do everything wrong and we're going to do everything we can to diminish the United States and everything we do. We don't have a government in Vietnam. We don't have a government in Germany, etc. We help these people. And George Bush, in the last 4 years, has not ruined education and health care and whatever. There is no vast conspiracy to ruin the United States. Are you a communist?
There are two questions there. The second one. No, I'm not communist. I remember the Communist Party and so on. I thought that was a question that left us a long time ago. I believe in a kind of socialism. I believe in democratic socialism. And I believe that the resources of society should be more equally distributed among people. And everybody's entitled to certain basic things. And, you know, you can call that whatever you like, but, I think that would be a good society. I believe in a peaceful world. I don't believe in war. The American people are not stupid, but they can be misinformed. And they have been misinformed consistently by the corporate media.